Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Achtung, Achtung, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, the Second World War podcast of choice. And welcome to our series about the race for Rome, with at its centre, the Battle for Monte Cassino. We're trying not to call this Monte Cassino, aren't we, Jim?
We're trying not to. We probably will end up calling it that, but, you know.
You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, which is really rather like what happens in this campaign.
Well, exactly.
And this, we're on part three, was scheduled as part two, but here we are on part three.
Yep.
And Jim, you've...
Yeah, I'm starting with a little quote from that great man, Audie Murphy, most decorated US serviceman of the Second World War. And he says, "Speech ceases. Our artillery fire is dying off. We see the fresh sod thrown up by the shells and know that we are near the enemy lines. Nervously, the men give a final check to their gear and weapons. We pause while the crouching scouts move ahead. This is the worst moment. Just ahead, the enemy waits silently. It'll be far better when the guns open up. The nerves will relax. The heart will stop its thumping. The brain will turn animal cunning. The job lies directly before us. Destroy and survive."
Wow.
See, that could only be written by an American, couldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. He can write, though, can't he?
Yeah, oh my God, his book is amazing. I mean, if anyone hasn't read it yet, from to Hell and Back, it's just, oh, so good. And curiously, written entirely in the present tense.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. Fascinating.
But I thought we should kick off this episode by kind of, you know, a lot of accounts of the Italian campaign, you could be forgiven for thinking that Italy doesn't exist except in terms of mountains and rivers. No one's living there. It doesn't have a population of 40 million getting in the way. And what the heck is going on? What's going on in the south? What's going on in the north? And so on. So I thought it'd be a good idea to just sort of very, very quickly give a brief kind of sort of picture of the situation in Italy.
If there's one thing that if you're familiar with the layout of fascist Italy, there's one character who's the, you know, the great mirror to it all, which is Count Ciano, isn't it?
Yes.
Mussolini's son-in-law, isn't he? And he writes these gossipy diaries, and he's a figure at the centre of all the sort of fascist intriguing. He is shot by firing squad on the 11th of January. So in our story, so this is what's happening in Italy, is the Italian government has fallen apart, recrimination's kicking off, the Germans have cracked down, the Italian army has surrendered the previous year, and no one really, you know, there's what do you do with all these Italians? What do the Allies do with all these Italian soldiers? And what do they do with Italy itself? And that's the thing, isn't it? Is that it's absolute chaos. It's anarchy, really, isn't it?
It is absolute chaos. It's total chaos. There's large stretches where, but it's completely anarchy. And the Italian people have just been completely abandoned, you know, materially, economically, spiritually, politically, any way which you want. They are literally fending for themselves. But what happens is Mussolini is deposed on the 25th of July 1943 by the Grand Fascist Council. And then that is authorized by the king the following day, King Victor Emmanuel III, because it's often forgotten that, you know, Italy is a monarchy and he's still in place, wretched fellow. And then on just after the avalanche landed, I think it's the 11th of September, he sprung from his mountain prison in the Grand Sasso, which is in the Abruzzi Mountains, which is in the sort of central southern part of Italy. He's sprung by Otto Skorzeny and his Fallschirmjäger landing in gliders and whisked back up to the north. And out of that is created the Repubblica Sociale Italiana, the RSI, the Socialist Republic of Italy, which is not, it's a fascist republic, a sort of neo-fascist republic, with Mussolini as the leader and Alessandro Pavolini, who is a very charismatic and dashing Florentine intellectual, who is very, he looks like and is cut from the same cloth as Oswald Mosley. And he is the leader of the fascist party. And it's absolutely a puppet government. They are, government centre is placed at a place called Salò, which is on the banks of, on the western banks of Lake Garda. But Italy is completely run, is occupied by the Germans and is run by the Germans. And Pavolini and and Mussolini are puppets. They have absolutely no control over anything at all. And the person who really runs it is Obergruppenführer Karl Wolff, who is an incredibly smooth-talking, very clever, very urbane, suave, senior Nazi. He's former chief of staff to Himmler. He's the number two in the SS alongside Ernst Kaltenbrunner, who is head of the Reich Security Services. And Italy's just stripped bare, like the Germans always do to all their countries that they occupy. All the industries are now working for the Reich. Italians have to pay 10 billion lira a month, which is $3 million, which is a huge sum in 1944. All the manpower's being creamed off. SS police units recruiting Italians, and also the GNR, which is the Guardia Nazionale Repubblicana, which is the kind of sort of fascist militia. Mussolini does persuade Hitler to let him raise four divisions, and the inscription ages 1923, 24, and 25. They have about 50,000 volunteers by the end of January. People who've, not volunteers, but people who've come along to be conscripted because they've been conscripted and have sort of accepted their fate. But actually, that's not very many. And an even larger part are starting to sort of take to the mountains. And this will only increase as the winter recedes and summer comes. So they've got a massive problem on their hand, because if you don't want to be conscripted and you don't want to end up as a slave laborer in Germany, your only alternative is to run to the hills, become an outlaw beyond the law and become a partisan. In the South, it's a total nightmare as well. You know, anyone who thinks it's any better under the Allies is cruelly mistaken. The difference is that the ultimate aim is one of benevolence rather than one of maliciousness. But conditions are absolutely brutal.
They're horrendous.
They're absolutely horrendous.
I mean, again, it's anarchy, really, isn't it? It's military. It's a military government. It's anarchy. I mean, if this is liberation, it's a pretty sticky wicket to defend, isn't it?
Well, it is. And so what you have is you have AMGOT, which is Allied Military Government of Occupied Territories. And the military governor at this point to start off with is Alexander. And then you have the King's Italy as well. But the whole of southern Italy is turned over to AMGOT and is run by the Allies with this, you know, kind of sort of local governance handed still into the hands of the king and his government under Marshal Badoglio. But it's not democratic, and it's, you know, they're basically just enacting what AMGOT tells them to do. What is happening, what is about to happen in January 1944 is the Allied Control Commission, which is going to cede power back to the Italians, but under their careful advice of the Control Commission. And the Control Commissions are made up of, you know, people like Harold Macmillan and Americans and Russians and French, who all have a sort of, they're part of the advisory council, it's called, who sort of advise the Italian government on what they should do, which basically is a euphemism for saying doing exactly what we want you to do. The problem is there is burgeoning domestic politics. So there is now the Committee of National Liberation, the CLN, which is made up of six parties, including the communists, including the Action Party, and various others. And they're all sort of brought themselves together, although they have quite wildly different political views. And there's Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, and so on, and the Liberals. But the problem is they refuse to serve under the king.
Yeah.
Because he's such a feckless idiot. You know, he was a king at the start of fascism. He allowed war to happen. You know, he abandoned Rome. You know, he doesn't deserve their loyalty and doesn't deserve to be king. And there is a big move to try and get them as the Congress of Bari, which takes place at the end of January 1944, where they basically finally, all those six parties finally agree on a course. And the course is going to be the moment the Allies take Rome, the king has to abdicate. And he hasn't agreed to this yet, but it will happen at the beginning of April. So it's on its way. But just to kind of, you know, one of the problems is that AMGOT is pledging kind of 2,000 calories per day per person. But the problem is they can't deliver that because the infrastructure is not there. To put this into some perspective, 75% of the pre-war trains, locomotives, have been destroyed. 85% of the carriages and wagons have been destroyed. 90% of the trucks have been destroyed. 87.5% of the merchant fleet have been destroyed. And the net result of this is you've got inflation rising by 321%. Which is largely the fault of the Allies for setting it at the wrong rate. And so, to put this in some kind of perspective, a civil servant in Naples would be earning 3,500 lira a month, which is the equivalent of $20. So, in today's money, that's about $440 for a month, and that's a kind of middle class salary. Whereas a postman would be on $1 for a month.
Right.
You know, it's just obviously that's like about $40. You know, it's just hopeless.
is it that the Allies, I mean, why is it such a mess in the South? Is it that the Allies in the end are just trying to win the war and they kind of don't care? You know, is there an element of negligence? Is there an element of, or is it, because after all, winning the war is obviously the priority. You win the war and then we'll get on with solving these problems. Or is it that they don't trust the Italians on some level?
Well, just imagine the war in Ukraine was over and you swept in and you go, okay, we're going to sort everything out. Do you think in a matter of 6 months, Ukraine would be a fully functioning, everything working again?
Absolutely not.
Because it's been destroyed. So what you've got in the run-up to the Allies' invasion of Italy in September 1943 is incredible rates of bombing. So Naples is bombed 200 times and 175 times in 1943 alone. Then the Germans, as they retreat, do a scorched earth policy and destroy everything, you know, electrical power stations, drain system, water system, electrical system, all this kind of stuff. That's all destroyed as they go. So all that has to be repaired. In the meantime, you know, disease festers very, very quickly. Then some of the strictures of Allied military government have been, you know, and the settings have all been set up by desk wallers back in Algiers at Allied Forces headquarters in the Mediterranean. You know, so a long way away, you know, writing rules and laws and instructions for a country they don't really understand and haven't really been to. I mean, the inflation rate, for example, the standard of the value of the lira is set based on the rate that it was in East Africa when they came in and took over in 1941.
Right.
I mean, the Allies had it, the British did. You know, so that's probably not a really good benchmark. And so that's one of the reasons why you've then got 321% inflation. And lots of the manpower is gone because the Germans have taken them or their prisoners of war camps in Britain and Canada and America. And so there's not enough money. There's nowhere to kind of make money, but there are lots and lots and lots of Allied soldiers coming around with money in their pockets and lots of tin cans. And the only way that the women folk can keep their families together is by prostitution. And so you have this huge, huge, huge problem. By January 1944, 92 out of 1,000 troops are suffering from STDs.
Yes.
50% of all women aged, let's say, it says available is a rather revolting term that the chief medical officer of the Fifth Army uses, but let's assume that's kind of 16 to 50. In Naples, between 95 and 100% of prostitutes have STDs. You know, and I came across this absolutely revolting story, which has absolutely just made my stomach churn, by a guardsman in the Grenadier Guards, and they're in a town called Canossa, which is on the Adriatic coast. And he and his fellows, they venture into town where they're immediately accosted by small boys pimping for their sisters. And so four of this guy's pals follow one of these boys home, and the family is living in a kind of small house. There's a mother and father, two daughters, about 20 years old. And they're absolutely astonished to discover that the father is the master of ceremonies, and the two older daughters take off two of the lads to one of the spare room. The mother accommodates a third of the party, and then eventually a 12-year-old girl gets produced, and she deals with the fourth. You know, and the father is the one who's kind of sorting this all out. I mean, it's just horrendous. I mean, it's very, very grim if you're Italian. I mean, the changes are on the way, and it does get better. But it's a slow process. I mean, this is a year of absolute misery for everyone in Italy. I mean, you know, obviously if you live in a kind of mountain village in Molise and the wars pass you by, you can sort of get away. But really, in the cities, it's a horror story.
I mean, it is obviously, you know, it will change and things will improve eventually. But I mean, if you're someone working at AMGOT, it must be incredibly depressing on some level. Or the people working at AMGOT are very cynical.
Most of them are cynical, and you know, it just becomes the accepted norm that what you do is you go on leave and you go and sleep with some Italian woman in return for some tins. And it becomes so, you know, and things which are completely unacceptable in civilian life, because everyone's doing it, suddenly becomes acceptable.
Completely normal, yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, an effect of war, isn't it? It's the Completely. Not just the brutalization to violence, but of all standards that comes with it. Because after all, you are on the edge of anarchy, aren't you? Right, that's what it's like being Italian.
Yeah, and I should also say that, you know, I mean, you know, the whole of Cassino has been evacuated the previous autumn. All those villages round about, they're kind of total ghost towns. There are still Italians. And they're just, you know, when they're bundled out by the Germans, just go. You know, there's no kind of social housing scheme. There's no refugee camp. There's, you know, they are literally dependent on going to mountain villages and going to second cousins or making, you know, living in a cave in the mountain or whatever. I mean, they're just completely left to their own devices. It's just unbelievably awful.
So, Operation Shingle. Now, I mean, in the last episode, we talked about how there was a little bit of sort of havering about whether to do this or not. But actually, the chiefs of staff commit to Anzio in the way that Alexander hoped and in the way that Clark expressed a rather firm interest that they do. Because after all, it's got to be too big to fail, is the truth.
Yes, it has. And Alexander knows that. There's no question about it.
Yeah. And there are the naval resources to put ashore two divisions, basically. So this is...
And a follow-up division.
And a follow-up division. So this is no small effort, after all. This is...
And it's also a bit like landing one division on Sword Beach, but it not really being one division, it being at least one and a half.
Yeah.
You know, these are divisions which have been swollen by vehicles, guns and tanks. And also coming up in very, very quick order is half of the 1st Armoured Division. So the idea that this is an army is being landed effectively rather than a corps or an outsized corps. I mean, it is not as feeble and bad as Lieutenant General John Lucas, who is the corps commander, kind of is making out it is.
So three naval task forces, five groups set sail from Naples, steam up. I mean, the thing is once you send three naval task forces steaming out of Naples, the Germans know something's up, right?
No, this is the most extraordinary thing. They don't pick it up.
Why not?
Because we got command of the skies, because they're constantly kind of paranoid about an outflanking maneuver, but they are simply not expecting it to be landed on the 22nd of January at Anzio. And what's really interesting is they do have spies and things behind the enemy lines.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Surely they have a grapevine.
Yeah, they do. They just haven't picked it up. They have not picked it up.
How extraordinary.
At all. It is a complete surprise. Total surprise.
The idea that five cruisers, 24 destroyers, 420 assault craft, 51 LSTs, 46 LSIs could appear by surprise. It's amazing, really. I mean, after all, you know, D-Day later in the year, they know something's going to happen. They can't quite pick where. But the idea that you could steam all the way up Italy from Naples.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And also, it's the British 1st Division. It's the US 3rd Division. It's also the Ranger Force, which includes four battalions. So, you know, that is like a brigade size plus, because it's the 1st, 3rd, and 4th Ranger Battalions plus the 509th Battalion, the 509th Parachute Infantry Regiment, and the entire regiment of the 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment
from the
82nd Airborne. So, you know, that's three divisions worth of fighting men in the first wave. It's a two-division assault, but it is actually, in terms of fighting men, it's a three-division men. And, you know, they land in the early hours, and at 5 minutes past three in the morning, General Mark Clark, back in just south of the casino line, receives the following message: Foggia, New York, Albany, Chicago, Omaha, Kansas City, which when decoded means landings appear to be proceeding on schedule. First troops have hit beach. No reports from landings yet. Troops have started to land on Yellow Beach, Red Beach, and Green Beach.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So is that Kansas City? So no reports from landings yet is presumably Omaha. I don't know. Anyway.
I absolutely love it. So Foggia is the landings are proceeding on schedule. New York, first troops have hit beach, I imagine.
Albany is no reports from landings yet.
Chicago is Yellow Beach. Red Beach is Omaha. Kansas City is Green Beach.
There you are.
I mean, that must be what that means.
That must be what that is. Yeah.
That's great, because that's not scrambled. That's just words that mean stuff.
I think it's worth just talking about Lucas. He's 52 years old. He looks older. He's grey-haired. He's got sort of, you know, round, wire-rimmed glasses. He's got a sort of, you know, a grey moustache. He looks like a sort of avuncular geography teacher. He smokes a corncob pipe. And, you know, there is no one else who could do this. It has to be an American show because it's Fifth Army. It has to be separated out. Although Clark wants it to be all American, Alexander insists on it being British in case it is a cock-up. He wants it to be, you know, shared blame. Geoffrey Keyes is the commander of two corps in Fifth Army, and he's already engaged in operations on the Gustav Line and was right at the beginning of January. So it has to be six corps, which means it has to be Lucas. And Lucas has done a perfectly adequate job up to this point. I mean, there's no alarms, but I mean, there hasn't anything been incredibly testing. But, you know, he is not a thruster. You know, he is no Patton. He's no Rommel. you know, he's slightly ponderous. He's an artillery man rather than an infantry man or an armored man. And a bit like Fred Walker and the Rapido, there's lots and lots of reasons to be worried about Lucas, because it's all sort of, I hope it'll be okay, but I have to say this feels like a really big ask. I'm not sure, you know, we can do what we've been told to do. And
later he basically says there's no point to it. It's stupid. We shouldn't have done it, doesn't he?
And so on the 21st, the day before, while he's in his cabin, you know, on the task force, he says, I think we have a good chance to make a killing. I have many misgivings, but I'm also optimistic. I struggle to be calm and collected. I wish the higher levels were not so over-optimistic. The Fifth Army is attacking violently towards the casino line and has sucked many German troops to the south, and the high command seems to think they will stay there. I don't see why. They can still slow us up there and move against me at the same time. That, to me, says someone who is riven with doubts and concerns and deep anxiety.
He's flip-flopping, though, isn't he? So one minute, it's going to go really well. I've got my misgivings, but I'm also optimistic. But maybe it isn't. I mean, you know, we've all had, you know, nights like that lying away in our pit thinking, God, what is tomorrow going to be like? But this is, he's not meant to be thinking like this. He's, you know, this is a...
No, he's supposed to be thinking with utmost clarity. Right, I've got to get there. My priority is blah, 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 blah. I've got to get off there. I've got to get these keys. I've got to get Cisterna. I've got to get to Campiglione Station. I've then got to push on into the Auburn Hills. You know, this is my brief. I've got to go for it. Alexander and Clark are so concerned about this, and they you can see they want to kind of put some kind of boot up the backside. So they go ashore that morning, and rather amusingly, Alexander sees a guardsman from the Grenadier Guards sort of shoving towards, moving this anti-tank gun off the beach, absolutely covered in mud and sand and wetness. And he just looks at him and goes, "You look extremely scruffy." The guy comes to attention, salutes, and goes, "Sir!"
Carry of course, on, he, very of well. Course he does. Extraordinary. Oh, dear. But, I mean, on the day, they put ashore, what, 36,000 men?
Yep.
3,000 vehicles?
Yep. It's a total cakewalk. There is literally no one there. I mean, it is as unopposed as you're ever going to get. There's a little bit of Luftwaffe. A couple of LCIs get damaged, but nothing to speak of at all. And you know, they're absolutely caught out. And British patrols get as far as 8 miles down the Via Anzate, which is this road that goes due north out of Anzio, straight up towards Albano, which is at the foot of the Auburn Hills, you know, perhaps 20 miles away, 18 to 20 miles away from Anzio. And they go down this road, but there's no... On day one, there's no dash for the Colli Lazali, which is these, you know, the Colli is hills, Colli I is plural. So it's, you know, the Lazali, the Lazia hills is basically how you would translate that. And they just don't do that. Kesselring is woken up very early on the 22nd of January, hears it about 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that, and invokes Case Richard. And
so he's just got Richard rather than Richard Dusseldorf.
Yeah, exactly. None of that.
Richard Dusseldorf Asparagus Banana or whatever. It's just like,
well, Richard is the operational plan for what happens if the Allies land south of Rome. There's a different named plan for north.
Yeah, of course,
Rome.
But I think it's a bit austere when you've got Foggia, New York, Albany, Chicago. I mean, the Germans aren't making an effort here.
Well, when they've got, I know, but they come up with some fantastic operational names later on in the Anzio campaign, so don't worry.
Don't worry.
In fact, actually, I'm a bit disappointed that we haven't got Paul to do Fish Fang for the
for the festival, for a beer. Right. So the landings are successful, but the British don't take the high ground, which is peculiar given how high ground looms in military imaginations. And Kesselring's assessment is that we have a problem, but not an insurmountable one.
Well, as you know, I'm no fan of Kesselring, and I'm very, very happy to stick the knife into him. But one has to admit that when it comes to reinforcing Anzio, this is where you're absolutely playing into his skill set. I mean, what Kesselring is very good at is organizing that operational level. He is supreme.
And here's the thing that, I mean, people who know that, you know, the D-Day story, that one of the great pieces of D-Day lore is that no one dared wake Hitler up to tell him what had happened, and that he didn't find out until lunchtime when he finally got out of bed. Hitler is woken at 6 o'clock at the Wolf's Lair, and he demands immediate action. And so that's what he gets. And 16 SS Panzer Grenadier are sent south, 65th Infantry Division, 114th Jäger Division, 715
Division from France.
I know. And the 4th Fallschirmjäger are brought down from Rome. So basically, the green light is given to all hands on deck. We're going to stop this landing, which actually has been essentially unopposed up to this point.
So check this out. So there are around 800 German troops of varying kinds within a kind of sort of, you know, 12-mile radius of the landings when they land. By nightfall, there's 20,000.
That's amazing.
But these are, a lot of these are kind of orphan units. So divisions, when they're moved south to the Gustav line or wherever they are, or from the Adriatic, they never move as a, you know, 15,000 men in a division. It doesn't happen like that. It's individual units go over and, you know, battalions and what have you. And it's all piecemeal. And so what you've got is you've got replacement units sort of, you know, I don't know, for the 90th Panzer Grenadier kind of hovering in that area, waiting to go down to the Garigliano front, and immediately they're diverted. First Fallschirmjäger Corps is kind of, you know, in the Ursenti Valley, that valley that cuts round behind into the Liri Valley from the sort of Minterno area, from the southern Garigliano front. They're kind of there. They're just about to deploy against the British 10 Corps when they get the order to turn around and go back to Anzio. So, you know, they've got all their vehicles with them. They just turn around and just crack on. There's lots of these little, you know, and also what you get is lots of orphan units, which are kind of, you know, a battalion of Tiger tanks, a battalion of Panthers, something else, some Nebelwerfers, which are not attached to a division, which are just sort of there. They're kind of sort of army reserve or whatever.
And plugged into what's going on.
And they're just plugged into. So it's just get there. Just get there. Whatever you can, just get there. There's a part of 4th Fallschirmjäger, which is Kampfgruppe Gericke. And this is basically a battalion plus a few odds and sods. And they're, you know, they are the closest. So they go down there and they're the kind of sort of advanced party of the 4th Fallschirmjäger Division, which is also part of the 1st Fallschirmjäger Corps. So they're starting to get in really quickly. I mean, this whole area is because it's January, and because although it's these are reclaimed salt marshes, it's still pretty soggy, the ground, and it's quite a hard place from which to attack. And what you're going to use, as is always the case, is you're going to use these main arteries because it's this flat plain. The roads tend to be a bit raised. You know, they're on a kind of slight...
They're causeways.
A causeway. That's the word. Yeah. And Clark immediately orders these kind of sort of rapid reinforcements. So the 45th Thunderbirds, they're ordered to Anzio on the 24th. Now, again, you know, the whole division doesn't arrive, you know, in one lift. It's several, you know, it's a regiment at a time. But, you know, they are cracking on. And the build-up of troops is pretty impressive. It's just it's not as impressive as the build-up of the German troops. So if they're going to go and do an attack, if they're going to get to the Colli-Lazali, they need to do it PDQ. And on D plus one and two, there's no sign of them doing it at all.
Right. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. We've set the scene there for 2 days of inaction. So we'll look at what else the Allies have at their disposal after the break. See you in a tick.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Part 3 of our Cassino Anzio race for Rome. It's not the battle for Monte Cassino, this, because we're not talking about that right now at all, are we, Jim?
Well, we're just about to, actually, but...
There are many, many moving parts in this saga. It is interesting, isn't it, this? Because, you know, if you dither and you give the Germans the chance to send people at you, right? Because their attitude to their men's lives is, you know, that soldiers are supposed to die, or die trying, at least. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
that if you give them the opportunity, if you give them this window, they'll grab it, won't they? And then they'll make things very difficult for you. This is the sort of, you know, if you hang around, if you don't grasp your moment, the Germans are likely to exploit it. For all that, you know, we on this podcast, we've kind of certainly tilted at the idea that the Germans are tactically brilliant all the time. But what they are really, really good at is once they've got people in place, you've got to kill them all. You've got to winkle them out. You know what I mean? So giving them time is always a bad idea, isn't it?
It's always a very bad idea.
There's never an occasion where the Allies give the Germans time and it's okay.
Yes, and I suppose the point is from Kesselring's point of view, he's got the ultimate backer in Hitler. And Hitler is very disregarding of people's lives. And he's also very demanding in terms of quick action and, you know, not giving up an inch and all the rest of it. So Kesselring, when he makes these decisions, can always make these decisions knowing that he's got, you know, Hitler's got his back. And that means he can just go do it and do it now. This is the Führer's orders. And everyone goes, okay, off we go. Whereas in the Allies, it's a kind of starting point for debate. And it's interesting because with Lucas, both Clark and Alexander are going, right, you are going to push on, aren't you? And he's going, yes, but, you know, I've got to kind of organise my ammunition dumps first. All right, great, but you will move, won't you? You know, I really think you should. And this is one of these moments where Alexander's suggestive approach to command decisions probably doesn't work in his favour.
Yeah.
You know, what he needs to say is, right, I need you to do this by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Yeah, finger out, get it done by the morning. Yeah.
But I thought also it's just worth just very briefly just mentioning the Mediterranean Allied Air Forces, which are absolutely enormous. And for those of you who've been listening to the pod before will know, and who listened to the first episode will know that one of the prime reasons for going into Italy was to take the Foggia airfields, this area of very, very flat ground on the Adriatic side, about a third of the way up, where you've got lots and lots of heavy bomber airfields from which you can kind of further tighten the noose, the strategic noose of the air war against Nazi Germany. But air power, of course, is absolutely at the very heart of what the Allies do. It's a force multiplier. It's to kind of ease things on the ground, all the rest of it. And Allied air forces in the Mediterranean have been building up and building up and building up ever since the kind of, you know, torch invasions of November 1942. And they are now, throughout the Mediterranean, absolutely huge. They totally have control of the skies over the whole of the Mediterranean. And, you know, we're now talking about 321,439 American, British and Duke officers, men and women.
It's incredible.
12,598 aircraft, of which 4,323 are in combat units. Now, that makes it the largest air force in the world by some margin. I mean, it is absolutely huge. But just imagine what that involves in terms of fuel and shipping capacity to keep that in place. And one of the big problems is that they can't bring it to bear in the way they want to because it's winter and it's miserable and it's raining. And they only get 6 days of flying in clear skies in January, for example.
Air power is even more vulnerable to the idea of a traditional campaigning season than land battle. You can slog on land now in this modern world of mechanized warfare. You know, it isn't easy. In our last episode, we did talk about how, you know, there was an enormous storm that held things up. So you can still be held up by the weather on land, but you can campaign through the winter in a way that you never could in wars of old. But the Air Force is totally vulnerable to the traditional campaigning season thing, isn't it? And I mean, it's interesting because we have talked in our last long serial, we talked about the, you know, US 8th Army, the 8th Air Force, and their attitude to precision bombing and the idea of precision bombing. I'm assuming we're not having that conversation in Italy, are we? Much. There's a bridge campaign, isn't there, that comes from Solly Zuckerman, which is the idea that you strike bridges and bugger up German transport. But, you know, they'll bomb around a bridge, won't they? That's the point. It's not particularly, they're not hung up on the precision thing in any way. If there's only 6 days of flying in January, they're not getting that done either, are they? So they have this tremendous weapon at their disposal and they can't use it. And that levels things with the Germans, doesn't it?
Yes, massively. It does when they can't be used. Yes, then it's a much more leveling of the playing field. So it's just a frustration. And it's not that the build-up of the air forces is the wrong decision. It absolutely isn't. But, you know, what one has to remember all the time is that the tyranny of Overlord is hovering in the background. That is the thing that's dictating the pace. And everything that's happening in Italy is happening at a rush. It's happening at a pace which is, you know, what they really should be doing is very aggressive patrol work along the Gustav line, whittling them down, probing away, and waiting for the spring. I mean, but they can't because of the pressure from above. So that, again, it's not Clark's fault. It's not Alexander's fault. It's not Wilson's fault. This is the fault of the combined chiefs of staff. But while all this is going on, there's also attacks going on against the Gustav line. And we left it with the defeat of the Texans at the Rapido. But Clark is not sitting with you. Again, for the same precisely the same reasons, it's this sort of, we've got to keep going. We've got to keep hammering the Gustav line. We've got to just keep probing away and pushing and pushing and pushing. And so there's now a kind of a new two-pronged attack. You know, they've tried on the Garigliano. They've made some ground. The British have still got their bridgehead over the other side of the Garigliano at the south of the line. 46th Division failed to get across. The Texans have failed to get across. Now it's the turn of the 34th Red Bulls, who are going to have to cross the upper Rapido Valley. So the triangular edge of the Monte Cassino Spur goes kind of northwest and north, if you see what I mean. One side of the southern side of it is veering towards Rome, and the other side is going kind of due north. And there's a flat valley into which the Rapido flows, which goes on for about three miles or so north of Cassino town. And then there's another chain of mountains. And at the end of that chain, it kind of forks. So to the right-hand fork, it goes to a kind of, sort of straight up into the mountains, a sort of river comes down from the mountains. And the other one, there is another valley, which is a Secca valley, which is very narrow. It's only about 500 yards wide, something like that.
Yeah.
Again, huge mountains either side. So the idea is for the Red Bulls to cross the upper Rapido Valley, which is, you know, maybe a couple of miles wide, something like that, through which the Rapido flows, and attack into Cassino town and get up onto the kind of onto the Monte Cassino massive. At the same time, the French, the CEF, the Corps Expeditionnaire Française, is going to do a 90-degree pivot from the direction in which it's going, which is effectively due north, and turn due west down from the mountains they're on at the moment into the Secca Valley, across that 500-yard gap, and straight up the next mountain, which is Monte Belvedere, which is a series of two volcanic craters which have long, long, long been extinct and filled in, but has little sort of knolls and spurs around the rims of these old volcanoes. And the highest point is 0.915, which is Monte Abate. And get up in there. Once you get onto that, actually up there, it's about 3,000 feet high again. But once you're up there, it's about 2,000. Yeah, it is about 3,000 feet, just under about 2,800, something like that. Once you get up there, it's not flat, but it's a kind of sort of one of those sort of weird mountain plains, which then rises up again to Monte Cairo, which is about 6,000 feet high. But these are two really enormous tasks, because the problem is that the Germans have dammed the Rapido at the north as the Secca flows into it. And what that means is all the water that's coming out is still trickling down through the Rapido riverbed, but has also just soaked the whole upper Rapido Valley, which is completely flat. And so it's a complete quagmire. And again, that's canalizing any advance onto the causeways, of which are very few. And they've laced it with vast amounts of mines. So the idea, and this is the outer line of the Gustav line, is at the foot of the Monte Cassino Massive. So on the, as you're looking at it, looking north, it's on the western left-hand side at the foot of the mountains, looking down across this flat upper Rapido Valley to the mountains beyond, around Chivaro and San Vittore and Sant'Elia. And it's just a soggy morass. And whether any tanks can get across that is kind of, you know, extremely unlikely, or in fact, any vehicles at all. If they do, they're going to have to go across this causeway. And so begins this kind of double-hitting attack, with the Red Bulls starting on the 24th of January, and the French starting in the morning, in the early hours of the 25th. And to cut a long story short, it's a horror story. I don't think we've really got time to go into any detail about the French attack, but the French attack is one of just the epics of the Second World War. It is amazing, because the CEF by this point...
Well, who are the CEF?
So there's three French armies. There is the Metropolitan Army, which is the home army.
Yeah.
Then there is the Colonial Army, which is from all over the place. And then there is the French North African Army. And this is basically the French North African Army with some colonial troops in it, attached to it. And these are Tunisians and Algerians and Moroccans. And there are only two divisions at this point. It's commanded by General Juin, who is very competent, very decent, gets captured in 1940, is a prisoner of the Germans, gets released, gets over to North Africa, is a Vichy French, you know, pro-Axis officer, but very quick to turn the moment the Allies turn up, and repeatedly proves his worth. He's a good egg and a good competent commander, and he's got good competent commanders beneath him. Because one division needs to protect the flank of the first division as it's pivoting 90 degrees, you can only attack with one division. And because of the narrowness of the space of these mountains, that basically means you can only attack with one regiment. And the regiment they attack with is the 4th Regiment of Tunisian Tirailleurs. And again, it's kind of two battalions. It's the 3rd and the 2nd Battalion that take the lead, and it is the 3rd Battalion that takes the ultimate lead. And he is, and this is commanded by Commandant Paul Gandoué. And Gandoué is a kind of sort of lifelong army officer and a French North African officer, and very competent. And all of these guys know that this is about the honor of France, and they need to prove a point and all this kind of stuff. And it sounds old fashioned, and the language in which they write about all this stuff is all kind of, you know, we had proven once again that France still has heart and courage and all this kind of stuff. And it's over the top, but they really feel it.
What are the French North African soldiers fighting for?
Well, they're also fighting for this idea of France. So, you know, we're, in the case of this, I mean, you know, when we think of the French and we think of the French colonial troops, we always think of Goums, these Goumiers, who are actually Berbers from French Morocco. They're not Tunisians. And these guys with beards and the stripy kind of ponchos and the huge daggers and the necklaces of German ears and all this kind of stuff. You're talking about a really, really small proportion of the CEF. The French Expeditionary Corps. It's just that the photographers always take photos of them because they're so interesting to look at. The vast majority of the troops are wearing American kit with French helmets. So they're wearing, you know, M41 Parsons field jackets, the boots, those kind of canvas putties they wear, leggings they wear, you know, khaki wool trousers. They look exactly the same. And a lot of the Tunisians particularly are you know, they're sophisticated Mediterranean troops. You know, they're not...
But are some of them fighting like Indian Army soldiers are fighting, look, we'll get this out of the way and then we'll deal with the question of independence? Because that, you know, that's part of what's going on with the Indian Army, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they are, no. I think they've all bought in... Most of them seem to have bought into an idea of France. And, you know, by this stage, you know, some of these Tunisian 4th Tunisian Regiment officers are Tunisian. They're Muslims, not Catholics.
Yeah.
And they fight with just incredible tenacity. And, you know, they're treated like, you know, and it's very, very clear that the white French officers, commanders like Gandoué and people like this, you know, they absolutely love them. I mean, you know, they there was a real spirit, brotherhood. This is not retrospective because this is all in the contemporary accounts. And they have to capture Point 470 first, which is, you know, one company is given this job, and they're supposed to kind of distract the Germans on this knoll, which sort of juts down beneath Monte Cifalco. And Cifalco is this huge peak, which the Germans still have, but you can't see the crossing point over the River Secca from Cifalco, but you can from Point 470. So you can't get across to climb Belvedere while the Germans are still on Point 70, literally kind of, you know, 700 yards away on this... straight across at them, you know, I mean, easily within mortar and machine gun fire. So this one company goes and sort of knocks them out. And it's just one of those kind of epics where it's kind of, they get the peak, then they get knocked off again, then they get the peak again, then they get knocked off again. It goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And meanwhile, then the lead company of the battalion then climbs up Belvedere, and they go up by going up this very narrow and steep gorge where quite a lot of the time they're having to rock climb. And because of the very quick turnaround, and because they were all going in one direction and then having to go in another direction, the mules haven't come up. So they all have to carry all the stuff themselves. And they have no idea when they're going to get resupplied. So they're absolutely laden with ammo and hardly any food. So they all take a hot meal on the night before, on the night of the 24th. And then basically they've just got K rations, which, as everyone knows, are kind of, you know, a third of a meal a day. And they're not enough. And they haven't got, you know, they've got their water bottles, but that's it. And they get up there and they do push off the Germans. And the reason they push off the Germans is because they're unspeakably brave. But the other reason they push off the Germans is because the German troops there aren't very good and aren't very numerous in the big scheme of things. You know, this is the 44th Hockendeutschmeister Division. Because in all other ways, it's completely impossible. But when you're there, when you go up to Belvedere and you look at Abati, you just go, holy moly. I mean, it's just It is insane how they do it. And to cut a long story short, again, I mean, the Red Bulls do get across and they do manage to eventually get a bridgehead over the River Rapido. And there's this weird thing that there's a kind of slightly, the western side of the Rapido is, so the Rapido runs down on that western side of the valley, the river course. And on the far side, it's slightly higher. So actually you can get to the eastern side, because then suddenly you're out of the arc of machine guns at the base of the mountain, of the foot of the hills. And they do get across, and they do manage to get some tanks across the quagmire, but only a handful, like four, I think. And they do start pushing into Casino Town as well from the north, and they take this weird set of old Italian army barracks, which is a kind of mile just north of Casino Town, nestling against the edge of the mountains. And then eventually, in a couple of days' time, I think by the 28th, they've got Hill 213, which is this key feature that overlooks another little sort of gorge which leads up into the mountain, up into the massive on one side, and then you've got the village of Kyra on the other, which leads up towards Monte Cairo and Belvedere and all the rest of it. So they do make progress, but what's absolutely clear is by the end of January, the French are holding Belvedere and Abate just by their fingertips, and mules start coming up just in the nick of time. There's amazing moments of heroism. So, for example, Lieutenant Bouakaz is one of the platoon commanders in the 9th Company, which takes one of the high points, I think point 862. And Bouakaz is a Tunisian, and he's absolutely vowed that he is going to be the first person on the summit. And just as they're nearing the summit, he gets shot and killed and cut down, and three of his men come along and pick up his inert body and put it on the summit so that he can still be the first one there.
My God.
You don't do that if you're not motivated.
No.
You know, it's an absolute epic. It's amazing. And the other reason why they survive and they pull it off is because of the, you know, absolutely insane artillery support. I mean, 10,000 shells fired in support of them just on that particular action. So what you've got by the end of January, by the 29th of January, you've got, and the other thing is that the 142nd Infantry Regiment, which is part of the Texans, which is the only of the three regiments, sort of what we would call a brigade, that isn't used in the Rapido operation, is shoved up on the left-hand flank of the French. So you've got them pushing up, going up. There is a sort of hairpin road, but you can't get that until you've taken other points. So they're able to advance up and that advance on this mountain village called Torelle, which is at the foot of Monte Cairo, up on this high mountain plateau. And you've got the Red Bulls in position on the lower hills now of the Monte Cassino massive further south.
But this raises a question, Jim. You know, the Germans are being, I mean, you know, we've talked about peace things being piecemeal, the Germans reinforcing, you know, in a piecemeal style, but they're being defeated piecemeal and in detail here, bit by bit, chipped away, dislodged, mm-hmm. closing on Casino itself. And the crust of the Gustav line is, it's breakable. And if let's say you've landed basically an army up in Anzio, and the Germans are reinforcing that, surely this is working.
It is completely working.
Well, so the thing you should do at Anzio is exploit like mad, right? At this moment.
Yeah. Well, we should finish this episode on that point, really, because back at Anzio, the Luftwaffe is, you know, part of the kind of sending all the German troops to reinforce it as quickly as possible is also sending the Luftwaffe as quickly as possible. So all the fighter planes which were in the north of Italy have suddenly pushed, you know, they're now south at Viterbo and places like this. So JG-53, for example, is parts of that are now being sent south. Bombers are being sent south. They're using their Fritz-X again, which for those of you who didn't hear the episodes about Salerno, these are remote-controlled rockets which are carried by a Dornier and released and controlled and directed onto a target. And they're quite vicious pieces of work. So you've got those two destroyers are hit. One of them's completely sunk. The other, a hospital ship, is sunk. And supply dumps are getting hit around the bridgehead, you know, around Anzio and Nettuno and all the rest of it. But what Blücher has done is he's already starting to feel very, very besieged by all this. He knows the Germans are massing. he thinks that, you know, he was always skeptical about driving onto the Colli Lazzali and onto the Auburn Hills. But now he's completely convinced that that's crackpot. And these are instructions being made up by people who aren't there, who don't understand the reality of the situation and all the rest of it. And it is interesting that when one looks at the analyzes the mission that he's given, which is issued back on the 12th of January, so 10 days before Shingle is launched, his mission is A, to seize and secure a beachhead in the vicinity of Anzio, B, to advance on the Colli Lazzali. Well, advance on and advance to
are very different things.
Well, they can be different things. It depends how you interpret them. But don't forget, this is, you know, this is where initiative and thrustingness come into play, because the thrusting general, you know, if that is pattern, he'd have gone. You know, he absolutely would have gone. He'd have sent out. And you know, these are not, you know, Sixth Corps is not short of vehicles and it's not short of armor.
He's got 356 tanks, 12,350 troops, vehicles, 61,000 troops.
But this is by the 28th of January.
Yeah, I know, but he's
so,
got
so
that
356 tanks.
Yeah.
Okay, and that doesn't also include tank destroyers, which he's got, you know, M10s. Lots of guns. He's got half tracks. He's got all sorts of armored cars. He's got all sorts of stuff. So, you know, his mission is to go and really kick some ass. And at the very least, he should, you know, so the British get up to Campo Leone station and do, you know, by the end of the month, which is quite a long way north. But there is a complacency that is set in here. There is a kind of sort of, we need to build up, you know, make sure that we don't get kicked into the sea. That's my first priority. So therefore, I'm going to build up my strength here first.
I must keep my feet on the ground and my forces in hand and do nothing foolish. This is the most important thing I've ever tried to do, and I will not be stampeded, he says on the 25th. I mean, stampeded by who? The enemy or his bosses?
Yes, and meanwhile, the day before, John Harding, who was chief of staff to Alexander, has gone, Sixth Corps, virtually unopposed, wish they'd get on quicker. I'm afraid we shall miss our chance unless they're really lucky. Well, he's quite right.
I will not be stampeded.
I will not be stampeded. So eventually, you know, and eventually both Lucas and Alexander go up on the 28th and go, you really need to do something about it. And Clark actually spells it out. He says, you need to have an action. You need to be on the way by the 30th of January. And so reluctantly, Lucas orders this. And the British 1st Division does quite well. It takes Aprilia, which is this one at this new town, which they just see as this kind of sort of carbuncle on the horizon. So they christened it the Factory. The Factory is not a factory. It is a Mussolini new town, but it's very underdeveloped. And then they push on to Campo Leone Station. So it's this big kind of sort of thumb-like pointed salient, which is sticking out. And obviously salients are vulnerable from attack from multiple sides. And that's the problem with a salient. So what you really, the moment that they've got this salient, they really need to push on. But the problem is in the American half of the advance, the attack on the 30th of January has been an absolute disaster because their intelligence isn't good enough. And he sent forward the Rangers without armored support. They've gone an infiltration because they think it's lightly held. And in the night, they go past various German outposts, which they just scuttle past because it's dark and it's night and they're Rangers and they can do that. And they don't realize that what they've done is they've got behind enemy lines and effectively surrounded. So the 1st and 3rd battalions get completely destroyed. You know, the Ranger battalions. It's like two battalions of commandos, I mean, or SAS or something. I mean, it's an absolute disaster. But there's no question that the disaster at Cisterna was avoidable had they got there earlier. Because the further they push inland, the further the range for guns, which means their defences are more vulnerable. Now, the counter-argument is the further you push in, the wider your defensive network, you know, your main line of defence is, because it's the further you push out, the bigger the fan becomes. But they've got enough troops to hold it.
But also the deeper your defences can be and more responsive as a result.
All that. Yeah. So on the 30th, the day that this disaster is unfolding, Clark goes, I've been disappointed for several days by the lack of aggressiveness on the part of Sixth Corps. Reconnaissance in force with tanks should have been more aggressive to capture Cisterna and Campo Leone. Repeatedly, I have told Lucas to push vigorously to get those local objectives. He has not insisted upon this with the division commanders. And he hasn't.
To which John Lucas, in his diary, then says, the strain of a thing like this is a terrible burden.
It's a terrible burden.
Who the hell wants to be a general?
Holy cow!
That's like almost the perfect thought to end it on, isn't it? Who the hell wants to be a general? Because after all, hindsight, are we putting too much hindsight in here? Is Lucas, because who the hell wants to make these decisions? You know, and he's burned off two Ranger battalions. And, you know, that going wrong would make you think, oh, I've got to be even more cautious now, wouldn't it? You'd think, gosh, God damn it, I've lost two battalions of my very best soldiers. I'm going to have to really, really take care from here on in. Rather than that proves that we got that wrong, so we need to, you know what I mean, Jim?
Yeah. You just, my kind of, sort of last thought on this is that you have to remember why it was started in the first place. This was to try and unseat the Germans from the Gustav Line. What you also have to remember, what has to be recognised, is that by the 1st of February 1944, every single senior commander, German commander in Italy is going, we need to pull back to the Caesar position, which is just south of Rome. We need to do this. We are absolutely in the shtick. The only person who's refusing to authorize this in Italy is Kesselring. And that's because Hitler's got his back and is saying the same.
Yeah.
So all those senior commanders, von Weitinghoff, von Mackensen, von Senger, people like that, Thurstein, who's just coming down from 51st Mountain Corps up in the north, they can't all be wrong. I mean, you know, and the fact of the matter is, the price for staying at the Gustav Line and the price for vigorously attacking Anzio is a terrible one for the Germans. I mean, you know, these units are absolutely decimated. And there are very, very few other fighting forces that would have stuck to it in the way that Kesselring insists they stick to it, which makes you think that Alexander's presumption is, or attempt, or punt, I should say, at trying to force them to, you know, the bluff of Anzio is a perfectly reasonable assumption. You know, one could be kind of wise after the event, it doesn't work. But it, as we will discover in the next episode, it so very, very nearly does.
Right. Well, there's the perfect point at which to end this episode. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to listen to this series about the race to Rome without adverts or all in one big dollop, and I have a suspicion if you've got this far, you're already on the dollop. If you want to do that, then you can join our Patreon. We have ways of making you talk Patreon, or go to our Apple Podcasts channel where you can subscribe for the price of, I mean, half a pint of beer in London these days.
£6.60 a pint of Guinness in the Queen's Head. Broadchalk.
Well, but that's in lovely rural. I mean, dear God, I went for dinner last night and bought dinner with a friend. And I wish I hadn't done that for someone's birthday. It's like,
oh my God.
Bankrupt. Anyway, the point is from you know, the prices of a pint of Guinness in Broadchalk, you can have these podcasts without adverts. Although, here's an advert for you. We do a festival because we have ways of making you talk fest for the 18th to 21st of July, where we talk the way we have been on this podcast. We have our favourite speakers, excellent historians, living historians. We have equipment. We have aircraft. We have entertainments of every kind, where like-minded souls who are afflicted with an interest in the Second World War get together and chew on the subject for a whole weekend. We have waysfest.co.uk is the website to buy your tickets for that. That's it, basically. Thanks very much for listening, and we will be back. It's a cliffhanger. Let's be honest now. It's a cliffhanger on the Casino Massif. We will see you in our next episode. Cheerio.
Arrivederci.